Good afternoon, fellow Patriots. This is Matt Shea, and welcome to Patriot Radio, broadcasting from the front lines in the battle for freedom and liberty, Olympia, Washington. Isengard on the sound, and brought to you once again by the Committee to Elect Matt Shea, Republican, and the legacy of Dr. Stan Monteith, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news. It's not about right or left. It's about right and wrong, about our hope not being in man, but in Jesus Christ, about not ending in prayer, but moving to action. And about the fact that there is a difference between the gospel of salvation and the gospel of the kingdom. The gospel of salvation is part of the gospel of the kingdom. But the gospel of the kingdom presupposes that we are going out beyond the four walls of the church and preaching the gospel and making disciples to the ends of the earth. And the gospel of the kingdom is what Jesus Christ preached. Go take a look at it. Jeremiah 17, 7 through 8. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, and whose trust is the Lord, for he will be like a tree planted by the water that extends its roots by a stream and will not fear when the heat comes. But its leaves will be green, and it will not be anxious in a year of drought, nor cease to yield fruit. I want to talk very quickly about what is happening here in Olympia and in from a spiritual perspective. When people begin to stand up, fight in the Spirit, people begin to focus on the presence of Christ in their lives, they're going to face opposition. We are going to face opposition. As individuals, we will face opposition. In fact, Christ said that there is a cup of suffering. Some say a baptism of suffering. And with suffering actually comes power, but not the other way around. Luke 21 talks about the idea that when these types of persecutions occur, that it is an opportunity for our testimony. That we wouldn't have that opportunity unless we suffered. Paul wouldn't have had the opportunity to witness to all those Roman leaders and Caesar unless he was persecuted, unless he suffered. Christ would not have had the ability to die for our sins. In other words, usher in the promise of eternal life and be a witness to the world unless he suffered. Peter, John, and all of the other apostles. And we think as Christians in America, it's never going to happen to me. What do you mean by suffering? Persecution doesn't really happen to me. And you use that word, and it's really not persecution. Well, Brother Yun, who is a Chinese church leader who was tortured, he was imprisoned, I think, for over 10 years. He said it was persecution because it's a little bit different. It's a little bit subtle. It's more with language. And interestingly, the persecution is coming from inside our own house. And it did in the former Soviet Union, where you had the state church split from the confessing church, which split off from it. And the state church began to be the instrument through which the communists persecuted the Christians. If you think about it, Jesus was persecuted first from inside his own house. Paul talks about it, how people left him when he needed the most. So this idea that we're not going to be persecuted is not biblical. In fact, what Christ says is exactly the opposite, that we should not be surprised when we're persecuted because they persecuted him first. And secondly, the persecution comes from inside our own house, and we are beginning to see people that would call themselves Christians persecuting other believers, sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes in trying to silence them, sometimes in a rush to judgment, sometimes in smearing or labeling them because of something that they don't understand. Instead of, and this is critical, doing what Christ said in Matthew 18 and going to the individual first, not going publicly, going to the individual first. And if it's a leader, later in the Gospels, or actually in the New Testament, excuse me, it says that if it's a leader, it's supposed to be two witnesses in the church. It's supposed to be two witnesses. Why aren't we following that? People think that they can just, you know, do whatever they want to. And I've seen pastors be smeared by other pastors or other members of the body, and they didn't go to them first. They didn't, let alone with two witnesses. They just put it out publicly. Oh, well, there's more than two witnesses. That's not what it means. It means to go to them individually so that reconciliation can be done in a gentle fashion. And I literally have seen really good pastors smeared because of people in the church. If you're not following Matthew 18, you're not following the gospel. And that's a huge problem in today's day and age. And we need to get back to that. We need to clean our own house up. We have to. There's no middle ground on that issue. There's no Matthew 18 really isn't followed anymore. It is a outdated. No, Jesus Christ preached the truth, which was yesterday, today, and forever. So Matthew 18 is the standard, yesterday, today, and forever. And we need to get back to that, and we need to repent as the body and repent individually for where we truly have not followed that. And that brings me now to our guest. All right, and my guest today is Michael Hammond with Gun Owners of America, one of the foremost organizations in the country on firearms rights, but most importantly, what distinguishes it from everything else is that it is uncompromising on the right to bear arms. And in today's day and age, especially with what's going on in places like Washington State and Virginia, that's absolutely critical. Michael, thanks for joining me on Patriot Radio today. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk a little bit about somebody that just passed away that I held in great esteem, Senator H.L. Richardson. Know you know who he was. If you could tell the listeners a little bit about him and his legacy.
Oh, well, he founded Gun Owners of America, so he's responsible for our organization existing. He was a go-getter in California at a time in which Ronald Reagan didn't necessarily always stand up for the Second Amendment, to say the least. And he wrote a book entitled "What Makes You Think We Read the Bills?" And if there is anything which is truer, it's that the legislatures engage in almost a reflexive either support of or opposition to issues like the Second Amendment without even thinking about it. And so he, for his lifetime, fought very hard for our cause, and he will very much be missed.
I completely agree. And his other book, Confrontational Politics, probably one of the best books I have ever read on how to actually be effective at the grassroots level, has changed many lives, especially in Washington State. I hand it out as much as I possibly can.
Well, I think that affected my approach. I, in the 70s and 80s, worked for the United States Senate and people like Jesse Helms and Jim McClure. And I can tell you that our strategy was to force votes on amendments on the Senate floor, which wouldn't necessarily win, but would force people to vote on issues which, in the case of the Democrats, weren't particularly beneficial to their reelection prospects. And so it was a strategy which I think has transformed our modern America and I think generally transformed it for the better.
I completely agree, and I've just had so many positive comments about how to teach conservatives and Christians as well to be confrontational. It can be a difficult prospect at times, but when they do, and they do it in the right way, a lot of things change at state capitals, and politicians in particular are held accountable. They know they're under the spotlight, regardless of whether they think they might be kind of hiding in the shadows, we can put the spotlight on them, and a lot of things will change. And particularly in states where they try to sneak things through, like Washington or even in Virginia, a lot of the bills that they will put forward are kind of distractions from what they're really trying to do with things like red flag laws.
Well, and ultimately their objective is a ban on private ownership of firearms, and there's sort of a trifecta of legislation which sort of makes up that general strategy. First of all, they ban semi-automatic firearms, and they do so as much as far as they can go. Our blackface governor in Virginia initially had legislation which would ban semi-autos held by about 1.5 million Virginians and then confiscate them immediately. I mean, you would be an immediate felon. The same is true with the regulations governing bump stocks. And in Washington state, the legislation says, well, you can keep your semi-automatic, but when you die, basically, semi-automatics are going out of circulation. And whether or not you they immediately express their ultimate goal or not. Their ultimate goal is banning private ownership of firearms. Now, I should say they combine these with red flag laws, which allow a unsubstantiated affidavit to send a SWAT team to your house in the middle of the night to ransack your house, and if you resist, to shoot you. If you think that's an exaggeration, we had a 62-year-old black man in Ferndale, Maryland, named Gary Willis, who was shot to death during a red flag raid at 5:17 a.m. of his home. The third part is these universal background checks, which require every gun transaction to have what's called a Form 4473, normally kept by gun dealers. Now, BATF, in violation of the law, comes through and photographs these 4473s. So if you have had a background check on your gun transaction, BATF probably has your name and the type of firearm you have in its gun registry. And so the universal background checks are de facto national gun registration. So we have a banning of guns. We have the authorization to send SWAT team to your house in the middle of the night. And then we have a list of homes for them to raid.
I think this is the one that really shows what the intent is here. And we in Washington State, I mean, look, we have Marxist, openly Marxist newspapers that have published and publicly stated that they want to seize firearms. They just have made no bones about it. But they're really going about it, though, in a hidden way. And the red flag law is a hidden way. We had this situation in Washington State where the FBI came to the King County prosecutor, said that they had an individual. They had no evidence of criminal misconduct, criminal activity on that person's part. But they went to the King County prosecutor anyway and said, we need to use a red flag on this guy because of his beliefs. And then they seized those firearms based on this individual's beliefs. So people that think that this is not going to affect them personally, or maybe that's hyperbole, that they're going to come after people because of their beliefs, it's already happened.
Yeah, and if you think basically this is unusual, the guy in Maryland who was shot to death, basically his aunt and uncle filed an affidavit on him because they didn't like his politics. We have a recent case of an affidavit filed on a individual, a policeman, who had been involved in this horrific incident in which this man with psychological problems basically was inviting police to shoot him. It was called death by cop. And when he lunged at them, they finally did shoot him to death. The mother of that man tried to obtain a red flag law red flag order against a policeman, stripping him of all of his guns for the remainder of his life. And in doing so, she filed an affidavit saying that she and the policeman, whom to my knowledge she'd never ever met, had a son in common, the son being the son who was shot to death. So we have a pretty extensive record of people who are willing to make misstatements or lies in order to strip guns away from relatives they don't like.
It is no question that that is happening, and it's not just limited to relatives. It could be friends. It could be neighbors. There was that incident with the war veteran who was sitting at a restaurant, and a waitress overheard him say something that alarmed her because she misheard it, and then they went after him with red flag laws. Yeah. So it's not just limited to family either.
Yeah, and increasingly, states like California, they start out, well, let's deal with relatives and police. And invariably expands to more and more categories, including neighbors, employers, school administrators. As a matter of fact, that's the way gun control works in general. People enact gun control on the representation that's going to, quote, make us safe, close quote. In fact, it doesn't make anyone safe. It puts them more at risk as a result of their inability to defend themselves. But their reaction is not to repeal the ineffectual gun control that didn't meet its promises. Their reaction is, well, we need more gun control. This just didn't go far enough. And so invariably, this is the game they're playing. And invariably, the ultimate destination is a point in which people are not allowed to have firearms as private citizens.
I want to kind of dovetail that into the idea that in these bills, we see them in Washington State. We have one coming up for a vote either today or tomorrow on the House floor, and I plan on speaking on it on the House floor. House Bill 1010, which allows for the destruction of confiscated firearms instead of what they used to do, and the State Patrol would actually sell these. And a lot of times you have minority populations and also single moms in high-crime neighborhoods who could buy these firearms for a lot cheaper than they would at retail at the store and allow them the ability to defend themselves. And yet these bills are actually denying people that would consider themselves on the left claim to represent.
Yeah, there are a couple of bills in Olympia which deal with that subject and basically allow the police to destroy the firearms as soon as the trial is over. And so, I mean, if there's anything that reflects the anti-firearm animus, it's to take someone's firearm, which is temporarily in the custody of the government, and say, we're never going to allow you to get it back.
Yeah, it's fascinating the tack that they're taking on this in Washington State as well in regards to the ban on so-called assault rifles and also the ban on high-capacity magazines. There have been a lot of incidents that have been well-reported by Gun Owners of America in the country where people have actually used an AR-15, and they've used a high-capacity magazine to defend themselves, where if they had something different, they may not have been able to do that.
Yeah, Sutherland Springs is an example. We see HB-2241, Olympia semi-mag ban, and SB-6077, the magazine ban, both of which essentially say, well, if you have one, you can keep it, but you can't transfer it to anyone. The notion being that in a generation, firearms ownership of at least the most popular guns in America will be eliminated. But Sutherland Springs is an example. 26 people killed at that church in Texas, and that shooter was taken down only by a guy with an AR-15. Los Angeles, the Rodney King riots, the Korean businessmen were capable of protecting their stores only because they stood on the roofs of their buildings with semi-automatic rifles prominently displayed, and no one dared try to burn down their stores, and in many cases their homes as well. My brother woke up in the middle of the night, found a drug dealer standing over his bed at 3 a.m., took a gun from his nightstand, which fortunately was loaded, stood the guy down until police arrived. We all know personally and from news clippings of people who saved their lives and the lives of their families and the lives of others because they were able to use firearms to defend themselves. And in many cases, these firearms were AR-15s and semi-automatic rifles, which would be banned if some people in Olympia had their way.
That's exactly right. And I heard the story, too, about a disabled man who was in a wheelchair and multiple attackers came in and he was able to defend himself because he had an AR-15 and a high-capacity magazine. And it story after story after story. But what's really behind this is a Marxist push, like you said, to disarm the population in America. And most recently and most prominently, we've seen that in Virginia. If you could give us your take on what's happening in Virginia, and if you can fill the listeners in that may not even know what has happened in Virginia over the last few weeks, fill them in on that as well.
Well, in Virginia, in November, basically, liberal leftist Democrats took control of both houses of the state legislature, and they already had this racist Democratic leftist governor in place. And so they had basically all branches of government. They have proceeded to pass one gun control measure after another, not to mention, of course, abortion legislation, which would allow you to kill the little baby even after it had been born. And not to mention the Equal Rights Amendment. So they just went crazy. They said that now we have an ability to pass the most extreme agenda possible. They start out with a legislation to ban AR-15s, AK-47s, about 1.2 million guns held by Virginians, and to ban them immediately and to send people to gun owners' homes in order to confiscate the guns and maybe arrest or shoot the gun owners. It turned out to be a little more than even some of the legislators could stomach. And so what we've passed so far in the Virginia State Senate is a universal background check, which, as I say, creates a national gun registry. So the legislators will know exactly which houses to raid in the middle of the night. They have passed a red flag gun confiscation law to authorize them, police, to go around to people's houses based on an unsubstantiated allegation. And as a result of that, this past Monday, the police say 22,000 law-abiding gun owners. I suspect it was more like 30 or 40 or 50,000 law-abiding gun owners descended on Richmond on Lobby Day to peacefully petition for a redress of grievances, as they are specifically allowed to do by the Constitution of the United States. The governor went crazy. He declared a state of emergency. And let me say a little of my history. I was behind the Iron Curtain in August of 1988, when Solidarity was striking in Poland. It was the first domino which ultimately toppled the communist bloc. And the first thing the head of Poland did, Jaruzelski, was to declare a state of emergency. So, the communist leader, or the communist pawn, who was the leader of Poland. So, despots of in all countries, in all parts of the world, in all ages, seem to respond to peaceful citizen petitions in the same way. They try to suppress them by force. And that's what our blackface racist governor in Virginia did. And it turned out that we were unsuccessful in challenging a state of emergency. So people who got into the very limited pen around the Capitol had to disarm themselves. I think unconstitutionally, but that crowd was so large that it spilled out of a good part of downtown Richmond, and no one outside the fence was required to disarm. So having a crowd of 40,000 armed gun owners, which everyone, including all the media and the blackface governor, predicted would result in horrific violence. Having had that, there was no violence whatsoever. I think only one person was arrested for wearing a scarf over her face, which was prohibited by Virginia law. And in the end, members and the members of Virginia Civil Defense League, I think, made a very strong point that, A, they were peaceful, law-abiding gun owners, who represent your neighbors and my neighbors, not the violent extremists that the governor painted them as being. And I think they made a very articulate case for why the proposals, the red flag, the gun confiscation, and the universal gun registry proposed by the Virginia Democratic Party was unconstitutional and counterproductive.
I think that that's where I kind of want to wrap everything in, and I want to come back to Second Amendment sanctuary, this idea. I agree with you 100%. I think it was unconstitutional. I had heard also that there was a law passed in Virginia in like 2012 that a state of emergency could not be used to disarm. I did hear that through the grapevine too.
Yeah, paragraph 3 of that law said, you can't use a state of emergency to take away people's guns unless you're talking about an emergency shelter. And so the governor came in and argued that the entirety of the Capitol grounds was an emergency shelter, notwithstanding the fact it had no tent or no roof over it. So, people who don't care about the Constitution also don't care about the truth. And so they lied their way and got pliant courts to allow them to agree to go along with this form of fascism. But I think we have demonstrated to the governor that his gun control doesn't represent the sentiments of the people of Virginia. And I think we've woken up enough people, so in the next legislative election, I don't think our people are going to be asleep as I think they maybe were in 2019.
I remember 10 years ago when I first came into the legislature that people were saying, it'll never happen. It's hyperbole. You're just trying to scare people and use fear tactics. They'll never try to seize firearms. And yet here we are. We're having this discussion today. And the fact of the matter is we still have a constitutionally protected right, because the right actually exists from God, not from the Constitution, a constitutionally protected right to peaceably assemble while armed. And what they're trying to do is say, if you're armed, you must want armed conflict. And that's a logical fallacy, number one. And number two, most of us are armed precisely to avoid conflict. And I think this is a principle we need to return to. Go ahead.
A large percentage of the 1.5 million people who use a firearm to prevent a crime each year in America, no shot is ever fired, as was the case with my brother. The guns were used as a prophylactic measure to prevent violence, and in fact did succeed in doing so, and in the process saved hundreds of thousands of lives. So, but C.S. Lewis in his Screwtape Letters said one of the most effective tricks of the devil is to convince you he doesn't exist. And for the liberal gun grabbers who ultimately want to take your guns and disarm you, to say, oh, no, that's not our intention at all. And then, although, you know, if you go to New York and someplace where guns are almost consistently banned, they're not arguing that those laws should be repealed. They say that's not our intention, and yet when the laws banning and confiscating guns are passed, they have no problem with that. As a matter of fact, are pushing them very hard.
And in fact, in every place where the population has been disarmed, former Soviet Union, China, Venezuela, Cambodia, I mean, you just go down the list, everywhere it's happened, tyranny has followed right on its heels every single time.
Well, when I was in Poland, I mean, we train pulled into Warsaw, and it looked to me like a suburb. It's sort of a modern apartment building and that. It turned out to be downtown Warsaw. The whole city was destroyed so completely and so thoroughly during the Second World War that there was no city left to speak of. And when the Jews in the Polish ghetto rose up against the Nazis, who were invading the country for the purpose of exterminating them, I mean, the first thing that occurred to them is, we don't have any guns. The Nazis have all the guns. And the reason was that almost immediately after Kristallnacht, they made gun ownership illegal. So there are concrete examples in our lifetime of cases in which populations were disarmed and then populations were exterminated.
And every time it's the National Socialists, in the case you just mentioned, or the Marxists, it's always socialist Marxists that are doing this. I want to go back to this, the idea of a Second Amendment sanctuary. In other words, the idea that the Constitution is actually going to be upheld in those places, regardless of whether or not a court ignores ignores the Constitution. Kind of talk about what happened in Virginia in that regard and how county sheriffs have been used.
Well, Gun Owners of America has, I think, been at pretty much the forefront of drafting sample Second Amendment sanctuary ordinances, which can be passed by counties, by municipalities, and by cities, in states in which very small urban centers end up taking away the rights of law-abiding gun owners in most of the states. Certainly, Washington is one of those, Oregon, Nevada, Colorado, Virginia, New York, and Pennsylvania are now joining in on that movement, and even North Carolina. In Virginia, 91 out of 96 counties passed our Second Amendment sanctuary legislation. Some cases it was stronger, some cases it was weaker. But 91 out of 96 counties said, yeah, you can do whatever you want to in Richmond, go to someone else to get your orders enforced. And in all, over the last time I heard, over 114 counties, municipalities, and towns had passed those ordinances as well. We have one sheriff from Culpeper County who says, if I need be, I'll deputize 2,000 people in order to make sure that these unconstitutional orders aren't enforced in my county. So it's really interesting to see how these crazy leftist governors, the black governor Blackface in Virginia, the governor of Colorado, and others are trying to threaten sanctuary counties. We'll bring out the National Guard to presumably invade your county. I think these are vain threats. I think ultimately, it's like Andrew Jackson said, Chief Justice Marshall has made his opinion. Now let him enforce it.
And I think that this is critical because about 4 years ago in Spokane Valley, Washington, they tried to enact a Second Amendment sanctuary for the city because we saw where it was going in Washington. Washington already has universal background checks. They already tried to pass bans on various things, and those are still, some of them are still being considered. And so people saw where this was going, and the immediate argument was, only the courts can determine what is constitutional. You have to obey the courts whether you agree with them or not. How do you respond to that argument?
Yeah, well, let's say Virginia passed a fugitive slave law requiring that slaves be lawfully returned to their owners. Would the state Democratic officials or would the local officials say, well, until this is adjudicated by a court, we're going to have to return these slaves? That's nonsense. All these officials put one hand on the Bible, lifted their other hand, and said they would uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, this notion that you're not entitled to say that this law, which is patently unconstitutional, is patently unconstitutional, I mean, that's almost, that's deceptive in terms of its implications because it says your oath of office is meaningless. You are required to violate the Constitution unless the court gives you permission to. No, to the contrary. These officials have all sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. And there are some things which are pretty clearly unconstitutional, and we all know they're unconstitutional. Washington is just such a sad case. You remember when they were doing universal background checks / gun registries at the outset, and they said, oh, these will keep us safe. It's a reasonable common sense measure, which is going to keep us safe. Well, it didn't keep Washington safe, and Washington is now still being characterized as a shooting gallery in some places, and they were back the next year for more anti-gun legislation. It's never enough. It'll never be enough until ultimately civilian ownership of firearms is eliminated.
And we just had an incident actually last night in downtown Seattle, as I understand it, where, I mean, this is the heart of all the most draconian anti-gun laws in Washington state, and yet violence still occurred. And this idea that it's just going to go away is absolutely ridiculous. I want to end with and conclude with a couple of questions in regards to, this idea of, that we were just talking about was settled at the Nuremberg trials. The German excuse of Befehl ist Befehl, an order is an order, was rejected as an international standard. There was independent moral standard, each one of us individually, let alone an oath, but individually that we were accountable for too.
Yeah, absolutely. The notion that you need judges. A permission, particularly in this era in which judges are increasingly becoming politicized. And there are certainly a lot of liberal crazy judges, and I assume there are even more in Washington State than there are in other places. The notion that you need a judge's permission to refuse to do something you find morally repugnant is certainly a violation of all the principles of the Nuremberg trial, and it's a case of the left striving for absolute power and using any crazy argument they're capable of thinking up in order to achieve that power.
So where do you think we're headed here in 2020? Obviously, the election is the culmination at the end of the year here. Where do you think this is all headed?
Well, I think the election is going to be critical. Our executive vice president, Eric Pratt, got up at the Virginia rally on lobby day and said no one should ever vote for the gun-grabbing Democratic Party again. And think that they are going to produce pro-gun results. This November is absolutely the crucible. That at that point we will determine which direction the nation goes, whether it permanently goes to the left and to suppression of firearms ownership in a way that's going to be very, very difficult to reverse, or whether it reaffirms the right to keep and bear arms. At this point, we are using our activities in Virginia. We're using every resource we have in order to try to convince people to register their relatives, to register their friends, to do everything they can to make sure that November reaffirms the Second Amendment rather than destroys it. And I might say that the reason we're going through this impeachment effort right now is because the Democrats took control of the House in 2018. A switch of 51,543 votes in a series of carefully selected districts would have left the House in the hands of Republicans, and we wouldn't be going through this. 54,000 votes made the difference in who controls the House or not. Similarly, here in Virginia, 5,000 votes in certain districts, had they switched, the legislature would still be in Republican hands. So it is a very, very small target audience that's going to determine whether this country reaffirms the Second Amendment or whether it destroys it. And I would urge you to do everything possible to ensure that those November elections reflect our values.
I think we're going to have the largest turnout we've had in the last generation. And the numbers you just cited, 5,000, that's one mega church. And evangelical Christians are they're the ones that haven't registered to vote. They're the ones that are registered to vote but don't vote. There's just no excuse. We need to show up and defend liberty in our country. And I think when people see this stuff, that it's not just about Trump or, you know, Matt Shea in Washington State, it's about them, and that this is going to impact them directly, they seem to be waking up right now. And ultimately, how do we deal with the Marxist penetration in America that has occurred, especially with the millennials? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there were so many people at this rally who said, well, we've never had any problem in Virginia with the Second Amendment in the past, so I didn't think I needed to vote. Well, I hope that our rally in Virginia, I hope our outreach to you, I hope that our national efforts will convince people that November is going to determine it. I mean, if we lose the House and maybe the Senate and maybe the White House in November, they're going to abolish the filibuster. We're not going to be able to come back in January and argue to uphold the Second Amendment. I mean, the fight will be almost impossible by that time, perhaps impossible. So we need to fight in November and not assume that if we lose that election that we will be able to somehow defend the Second Amendment after that.
So if people want to get involved, if you could tell them how they can join and go for more information to Gun Owners of America. It is a tremendously effective organization. A lot of people in our area have heard about it, but a lot of people haven't. So if you could, give it a plug.
Yeah, come on to our website at gunowners.org. It's gunowners.org, and we'll have information as to how to join. We'll have information as to what's happening within, I think, next few hours, I'm probably going to write an alert on what's happening in Washington State. And so, come on, even if you can't contribute to us right now, come on and be part of the battle to defeat this anti-gun legislation.
And for the record, I am a LIFE member, so I just appreciate everything that you guys are doing. And in just a last final thought, if you could address the millennials, address the younger generation, why should they care? It's an old antiquated thing in the Constitution. That was for the 1700s and 1800s, not for today. How do you address the millennials on that stuff?
Well, I had a fairly good friend who worked for Tom DeLay, who ran the House of Representatives, and he was we spend about $1 billion a year with armed guards guarding the United States Capitol. But in the late 90s, that didn't stop a gunman from breaking into that building and running through the offices, killing people. And as the gunman approached a sort of a V in the hall, if he went left, he would have been face to face with my friend and he would have been shot dead. If he went right, he would be face to face with Officer Chestnut. He went right. Officer Chestnut was the one who died. But as my friend stood there wondering whether he was going to live or die, the thing that kept going through his mind over and over again was, I wish I had a gun.
That's powerful. That is absolutely powerful. Thank you very much, Michael Hammond, Gun Owners of America. Appreciate you joining me on Patriot Radio today. Keep up the fight.
Thank you so much.
Again, gunowners.org, gunowners.org, and that was Michael Hammond. Very articulate. Those guys have been fighting on the front lines across the country for years. Really appreciate what they're doing. All right, I'm going to move now to your daily intelligence briefing. I want to go through a few bills as well toward the end of this. But first, on the international front from North Korea, sometimes I kind of wonder if I'm living in a bizarro world, okay? But the New American has an article where the United Nations is now throwing cash at North Korea to fight global warming, because the North Korean regime is going to use that money to fight climate change. They're not going to use it to oppress their citizens continually and build their military. That just can't happen. Oh, my goodness gracious. And you see stuff like this, you know it's happening, you know what's going on. And here they are doing that. So the United Nations, another reason to get out of the United Nations. All right, also on the international front, coming to us from Debka File in Israel, the new ISIS leader is identified as the Iraqi Turkmen al-Salbi. At least he'll be the leader here for a little while, the temporary leader of ISIS. Also from Israel. This is really important. Pay attention to this. This is very, this is the stuff that changes history, even though it's kind of subtle. Benny Gantz, who is the opponent to Benjamin Netanyahu, has now come out publicly backing the Jordan Valley annexation. So Netanyahu had already come out. Trump and Pompeo had come out and said very clearly that the United States would back, this is reversing 40 years of U.S. position, by the way, and back the Israeli annexation of the Jordan Valley. Now Benny Gantz has come out and said that. So what we have now is both sides, no matter who wins, they're supposedly going to back the Jordan Valley annexation. And of course, that would include Qumran. Remember the Copper Scroll Project. Extremely important stuff there. All right, also on the international front, it looks like the Venezuelan opposition leader may visit with the Secretary of State in Colombia. And so some things may be happening in Venezuela here very shortly. So just keep your eye on that, because typically following these types of meetings, something occurs very, very quickly. All right. Also on the national front. And this, again, I'm going to keep talking about it. The Financial Times, one of the largest mainstream publications on the economy in the United States, if not in the world, published an editorial advocating for United Nations intervention in the United States in our elections, but then went even further and said that we need to rewrite our Constitution with something like a Loya Yurga, that is an Afghanistan tribal council. In fact, not representatives of the people. In other words, these would be self-chosen tribal council members to rewrite the Constitution of the United States. Okay, there are a couple points here. First of all, 10 years ago, people would have said, that's hyperbole, it never happened. But the New American, for example, and the John Birch Society have been talking about this for years, and here it is, black and white, that's what they're advocating. Number two, the Convention of States. A lot of people listening to this show that would support that. But what is my dramatic concern is when the Convention of States has now teamed up with Wolfpack, which is funded by George Soros, and then an article comes out like this where they want to rewrite the Constitution with a Loya Yurga. And oh, by the way, the delegates to a Convention of States wouldn't necessarily be representatives of the people. The people wouldn't necessarily have a direct vote on that. This is the kind of stuff that you have to look at the long game. What is the trick behind the scenes to try to get us to a point where they can rewrite the Constitution? Because the problem is the Constitution is in such plain language that it's very hard for them to argue against. When it says, shall not be infringed, when it says in the Washington State Constitution, Article 1, Section 24, shall not be impaired regarding the right to bear arms, they have a very hard time arguing against that. And when they begin to ignore the Constitution, people lose trust in the courts, for example, legislators, for example, in those institutions, then it begins to destabilize, and you see things like what's happening in Virginia where people are just saying no, and it's returning to the individual level. And I want to clarify about that wording of destabilize. It becomes polarized, and in that sense, and this was actually kind of alluded to in this Financial Times article as well. So even they're recognizing it. So just pay attention to this stuff. The Public Records Act, the new Public Records Act in Washington State, where this ruling from the Washington State Supreme Court that each individual legislator is an agency. So now legislators are going to be spending their time searching for records potentially instead of representing the people. Some implications there, but also this implication. I've been an advocate for transparency my entire time I've been down representing the great people of the 4th Legislative District. But here is the key issue. All of the gun owner emails that come in now to the legislature are potentially public record. So the Marxists can now get the list of the folks sending stuff in and then turn that around. And they have stated this in Washington, actually in Spokane County, they've stated their intent is to get lists of conservatives and then go harass them at their jobs. And they don't call it harassment. They say, oh, we're just going to have a conversation with the boss. We're going to let them know who they've really hired. They really need to know who they've really hired or who they've donated to. When the Southern Poverty Law Center was one of their proxies, sent a letter to every single one of my donors, this is what they are doing. So look at the long game about how this can be used by the Marxists to try to implement tyranny. It's absolutely critical. All right. I'm going to move now to the regional front and talk about some of the bills that are out there right now. House Bill 2240, this is the ban on magazines over 10 rounds. House Bill 2241, this is the ban on so-called assault weapons. Also, you've got a few others that people haven't been talking about. House Bill 2419, which amends the Death with Dignity Act, in other words, allowing or trying to make it easier to kill people that have apparently lost their value to society. Where are we headed with some of this stuff? In addition to that, ID cards for homeless folks, which in some states they've raised the concern that this can be horrifically abused. House Bill 2565, requiring the labeling on flushable or non-flushable wipes. House Bill 2602, hair discrimination. House Bill 2747, establishing the state micro animal, the moss piglet. I'm sure the moss piglet must be really cute. But getting back to bills to be concerned about, House Bill 2651, freshness labeling. I wonder what that could possibly mean. And then lastly, House Bills 2622 and House Bills 2623 regarding, again, cracking down on firearms owners. A lot of these ban bills are distractions to what the real agenda is, and that is through the courts, with minimal due process, if any at all, to try to seize firearms from law-abiding gun owners solely based on their beliefs, as we talked about during the show. That's what you really need to pay attention to. And if you get the opportunity, make sure to come down, actually, to Olympia. Come visit your legislators. Just talk to them in person about this stuff. And it doesn't matter if they're Republican or Democrat. Just talk to them about it. See what they have to say. This year, the fence is being removed. The middle ground is being removed. This is a year of the valley of decision. We need to stand up. We need to vote. We need to defend liberty for the next generation. Because right now, the Marxists are on full attack. And it's not just life, and it's not just liberty, but it's also property and the ability to defend the same that they're going after. And they think that they want to try to culminate it this year in 2020 with the elections. Let's show them what it means to be Americans, stand our ground in defense of the Constitution and in defense of liberty. This is Matt Shea. Thank you once again for joining me on Patriot Radio. May God bless all of you, and may he make this generation the greatest one.